Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are fighting unethical persuasion wherever it rears. I got to work on that one. Wherever it rears its ugly head, wherever it opens its ugly mouth, that's our job as rhetoric warriors. Take it down. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, escaped professor. I'm also a stand-up comedian and comedy writer from late night in Hollywood. I write jokes, political jokes, all day long at Twitter, on Twitter at Rhetoric War. Check those out if you're a fan of jokes. Many people are, I think.
No. No one likes jokes anymore.
Brandon? Here are a few jokes. I like to rewrite things. I think we need better headlines out in the world. I think this one would be a lot more specific if they just said social media kicks off dangerous liars. Like all the conservatives are bitching. Hey, they're getting rid of me. And I'm like, yeah, well, they're going after the dangerous liars. So if they went after you, guess what? Take a look at the way you talk. I think Fox needs to be renamed. I think take it off the air unless you can rename it. Maybe even just rename it Sly Fox. And their new slogan is 24 hours of total shit. All shit all the time. A little truth in advertising will be fine. That's all I ask. And finally, I think I was wondering about this. Shouldn't they at least be middle-aged Mutant Ninja Turtles by now?
Absolutely.
That thing started in 1987.
I would watch that, to be honest with you.
They got to be in their 50s.
Easily.
Yeah.
Like landlords now or something like that.
Yeah, they got like little turtles who are just screwing things up all the time.
Michelangelo owns a pizza shop, you know, maybe a franchise.
He can't get out to fight. He's got the kids. You'll know about that. Well, this is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast where I convert conservatives. That's always fun. I talk to comedians about their politics and I get persuasion advice from persuasion pros. So go to rhetoricwarriors.com, sign up for one of our courses. I just released Converting Conservatives, which is a 25-week course in how to get your crazy uncle to shut the fuck up at Thanksgiving.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Best course ever.
Yeah, and it turns out like if you actually apply some concepts, you can make some inroads even with the crazy. So I teach you how to do that in that course. But take one of the courses. They're all $25, 25 weeks. It's $1 a week. So I know it's a pandemic, but you know, there you go. My guest this week, great dude. Really like this dude. Chicago native, right?
Yes, sir.
Chicago guy, he's got a beard. He's a comedian, comedy producer, marketing man, has 11 kids and a very hot wife.
That's 11. What Jewish people used to do. So, you know.
He's Jewish, but he's married to, what's your wife?
She's half Puerto Rican, half black.
Half black, half Puerto Rican, Jewish from Chicago. You guys got it all. You are a sitcom.
They have all the works, you know.
Well, don't they have Mixed-ish out now? Isn't that a sitcom that's out now?
Yeah, it is. I don't think it's doing very well, but yeah. I think if you have a wife or just a female who's half Puerto Rican, half black, it has to be on a service where you can swear, right? Like there's no way that can be on NBC and be still funny. Like, you know, I'm like, just spend an hour in my household and me picking on my wife and you'll see exactly what I mean, you know.
That should be completely, I've had this, you know, problem with network TV forever. It's like, hey, grow up, we're adults. Go ahead and make the transition. Cable did.
Yeah.
You know, what's gonna happen if like you just opened up all the gates and let everybody start talking like real life on network TV, the conservatives would be upset for a while and then they would shut the fuck up.
Exactly. You just know not to put like a 6-year-old in front of that show at that time. And they shouldn't be because at like 7:30, they should be in bed anyways. But, you know, that's just me.
Well, and even, you know, the kids, you know, there are ways of exposing kids to things. And I slow exposed my kids to things. Like I slow rolled, you know, we had some friends that let their kids watch horror movies when they were little.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, and they're like, oh, that's fine. We've worked through it. And I'm like, both those kids are weird. Like now.
You know, what's funny though, is like, I was thinking about this too. Horror movies. I mean, it's like one way or another, right? Like they either are going to get really scared and you can't show them the movies, or they're like numb to it for whatever reason. Maybe they're just dead inside for how they were born.
But their home life is so bad, the horror movie looks like an upgrade.
Exactly. But I remember my dad let me watch my first horror movie when I was 9, and it was The Exorcist.
Start with The Exorcist.
Oh, man. So I don't know what was wrong with me, and maybe this like answers a lot of questions why I am the way I am today, but I was laughing during the entire time. Like, it was just funny to me about how ridiculous some of the shit was. And then I had two of my best friends sleep over like the next weekend. And I was, and they're like, what should we watch? I was like, let's watch The Exorcist. And sure enough, we did. And I knew all of the parts. So I scared the shit out of them. And it was so much fun to watch them. And then they got upset too, because they were like very Catholic. And they're like, why is she stabbing herself with a cross? I'm like, she's the fucking devil. Like, Jesus
Christ. Yeah, the devil. Devil tends to go over the line.
Yeah.
With the Christian tools. Notice.
You know, another point to that, though, is that I've listened to another podcast with a lot of like Hollywood producers, and they always say, like, in their story, they were raised on movies they probably shouldn't have watched at a younger age, right? And so it kind of like leads you into that path. So I always tell my kids, because I let them watch shit they probably shouldn't watch either, not horror movies, because my kids still kind of get scared of that stuff, but there's still things like action movies and so forth that they get into. And I'm just like, hey, become Hollywood producers and we'll be fine.
There you go. That's I like it. I like how that is the trajectory. By overexposure to shit that's going to traumatize you now, you're going to be super successful later in life. That's perfect. I like that parent logic. Like, my daughter, I had to leave Winnie the Pooh when she was little because bees were chasing Piglet. Mm. And she's like, she couldn't handle it. I'm like, they're not going to catch Piglet, I promise you. And we had to leave. So it's all different levels out there. So just set your background a little bit for everybody. Just introduce yourself just a little bit so we know what the Brandon Lewin brand is.
Sure. Yeah, I'm Brandon Lewin. I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois. I was born and raised in the suburbs, actually just outside of Chicago. And then I went to college at DePaul.
Do you get to claim Chicago if you're from the suburbs?
I mean, I was in Skokie, so it's like the next one over. Like, you could take the yellow line into the city in like 15 minutes or less. And so, like, yeah, that to me is
okay.
Close enough.
Like, that's close enough.
Yeah.
It's exactly. Like Brooklyn and New York. It's like Brooklyn and Manhattan. Like, you get to see New York if you're Brooklyn.
Yeah, for yeah, sure. I mean, sure. It's the same thing. But like, what I don't get is when people are like, oh, I'm from Chicago. I'm like, oh, yeah, what part? And they're like, from Naperville. I'm like, yo, dude, that's like 45 minutes to an hour and a half outside of Chicago. You're not from Chicago. So that's a different story. I grew up there and I went to school up there. And then I came, I started my first business. So I was always an entrepreneur growing up. My dad has run his own business for 40 years. I remember I had like one of those like entrepreneur stories where I shoveled snow when I was 10 years old and raised $100, you know, bought myself a pair of sneakers that I probably didn't need to get, but whatever. Like, I fucking loved Jordans at the time. So that was actually how I got into that. I asked my dad, I was like, hey, I want a pair of these Jordans. He was like, fuck you. Not in so many words, but he was like, you know, if you want them, you got to earn them. And I was like, how do I earn them? And he told me how to do it. And then I went ahead and did it and worked out great. And since then, I've always
been shoveling driveways ever since.
Ever since. And shit. You know, that's just.
As long as you got a shovel, man, that's all that really matters. That's
all you need. I mean, shit, you can make a lot of money with just a shovel.
It depends on where you go, I guess. Like, you know, nuclear waste. Hey, if we pay you, yeah, you got a shovel, right?
Yeah, maybe not that profession. But so I got after school, started getting into different things. And one of the I started getting into marketing was one of the areas that I really liked.
You're a hustler. You're a scammer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm Jewish. I mean, of course. So,
well, I mean, that's the low level. Like, people, you know, when they say marketing and, you know, online work and stuff like that, you know, there's that whole ilk down at the bottom of it. That's they'll sell anything. They'll use any technique. It is Scamville, right? And then there's that kind of middle that's sort of mixy.
Yes.
You know, where you do a little of this, a little of that. And then there's the high end where if you're a marketing agency and you're working for clients that have a bunch of money, you can do all the above board stuff.
Yes.
You kind of live in those three worlds when you do marketing.
You do, man. And what I, but see, and I was just thinking about this is it, what I always did was I always did things differently, right? Like I always like to do things against the grain. And I don't know how that kind of came about doing it, but I think it was just about learning how to be, you know, providing a value proposition and separating yourself from the rest. And I think it was that book was like called Blue Ocean. I don't know if you've ever read it or forgot. It's like Blue Ocean something. But it was so good that I remember the title.
Blue Ocean. How can you forget Blue Ocean?
I think there was like another part to that title, but whatever.
Well, the rest of the title wasn't any good.
Exactly. That's all you need to know is Blue Ocean. And so, but when I started doing marketing, I did it social media. I started a social media marketing agency in 2007, 2008. And that was, and I did that because I actually had a financial service business. I know, surprise, a Jewish person in the finance world. And
I like how you're taking your own shots at the Jewish population.
Absolutely. I mean, I love stereotypes, and I feel like this culture right now is so fucking soft that we can't talk about stereotypes to a certain
extent. Well, we've gotten out of practice for sure. Like there's the oversensitized reaction to it, and then there's the undersensitized reaction to it, right?
Yep. You know,
forever the Archie Bunkers, like they sanitized that guy. He was completely a racist, you know, and you never really got to hear any of the racist words, you know, on that show, which I always like that fascinates me. Like, yeah, well, comedy can sanitize anything and put it on the network if it wants to.
True.
It just has to avoid, you know, the same way like Trump avoided. The only thing I ever really admired about Trump was his one iota of restraint, which is to never use the terms that would get him into trouble.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He could go right to the edge, like he would say low intelligence person, you know, instead of retarded, which is what we all knew he meant.
Exactly.
And that was the one thing I admired in his skill set, was the ability to take it to the edge, but never go over it, you know, never.
Do you think he's really stupid, or he's just really smart and knows how to market to the right people?
I think he's a super marketer. I think he's a promoter. He's got 40 years experience promoting, and politics is no different. The skill set transferred very well. They just gave him a different script.
Do you think he really went off the edge? Like it seems like toward the end, he was about to fucking jump off the cliff.
I think the problem with promoters and marketers, as you probably well know, that they will push every envelope as long as it's getting results. They'll keep hitting that button. And he went through everything. He went through the whole repertoire. I've got a thing about this actually in the Converting Conservatives class where I break down all the different techniques Trump used. And he finally got all the way over to fascism.
Oh, okay.
Because everything else stopped working. You know, he lost the election. And how are you going to win in democracy once you've lost an election? Well, you don't. You have to get out of democracy. So he switched to fascism. And then people were like, oh, you know, I don't think we want that one.
That one doesn't taste too good. Push that back one back.
Yeah, you know, 2,000 idiots hanging on the congressional building. I don't think I like that one. But everything else, that's true. You know, he pushed all the buttons. But so I don't know. You know, but marketing, he's a promoter. Marketing is find what works. I mean, you have to use what works, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you know that from social media. You got into that early, right?
Yeah. So that's why I started with social media. And I remember like the first time I talked to somebody, I had a financial service business and I actually created a Facebook group that was like fairly new back in like 2008. And I started putting all my friends from like high school and like all walks of life into there and just started, you know, sharing content essentially around what people at that age should probably do, which really isn't much from a financial service perspective, but it worked. Like I started getting some business out of it. And I told a friend of mine about it. And she was like, you do what? She's like, why do you use Facebook for business? I was like, I don't know. It just works. I'm like, it's another opportunity. And sure enough, look what, you know, how everything kind of changed as time went on. So Yeah, social media was great. That's the first business I started, and I've been using it ever since. Like, I actually, at this point, I'm kind of like sick and tired of Facebook. I'd rather not be on there if I don't need to be. But I have to be on there quite a bit because I use it for, obviously, for business purposes. But even like from an advertising and marketing perspective, that's starting to lose a lot of traction. Like, yeah. You know, used to be able to use it pretty, you know, pretty well, like getting good results, but it's just not producing the type of results it used to. So,
yeah, I think all those platforms, right? And every channel that you pick, if it's successful, everybody's going to flood it. And then the channel itself is going to start shutting things, you know, off so that it can make more money.
Yep.
And they just ruin the channel. And so that's why you're constantly moving to other channels and other platforms. By the way, if you need to ever stop, you know, if you get a phone call, just tell me and I'll hit pause. Okay. Brandon's actively selling tickets today. So he's got phone calls that mean money as opposed to Zoom calls, which mean squat.
I'm always, yeah, I like, so this is one thing too, is like, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing. I think it's a good thing, but it's just to the point where like, I'm just constantly on my phone, is that I try to provide the best customer service, right? Like you call or text, I try to get back to you as soon as possible. And it's funny because I was telling Jazz, my super hot wife, for everyone who doesn't know, I was telling her, like, people always, every time I respond to somebody, they're like, wow, thank you so much for the quick response. And I'm like, why do people keep on saying that? She's like, just because people don't take care of customers anymore.
Yeah, it's way expensive. It's way hard work. Businesses just avoid it.
Yeah.
As much as they can. And who knows how much that actually costs them for real. You know, the customer adherence and the customer dissatisfaction goes up and, you know, all that stuff. But it's a bear, man. Like you said, your phone's right there yelling at your face all the time.
All the time. And I mean, and you're right. Like there's certain times, but I'm pretty much around my phone anyway. So it's like, what does it take for like 10 seconds to take a response? You know, most of the time I'm like, even especially when it's happening, because a lot of times it happens at night. So I'm like sitting around watching TV or something with my wife. It's not like I'm, you know, in the middle of a.
Yeah, it's not important. You're just with your wife. It's whatever, you know.
We're both the zoned out of the TV. You kidding me? We got three fucking kids. Like at that point, we can't say two words that make sense, you know?
That's funny.
So.
But you've got, okay, so you brought this background. This is one of the things I've always been interested in. And I've seen this a lot in comedy. Because I've been in comedy for almost 40 years now, in the sort of lower trenches of stand up, and then, you know, in the sort of middle ground of it, and then the, you know, in TV in the upper echelon of it. And it doesn't really change across those things other than money and talent and, you know, resources and things like that.
Sure.
But in stand up, there was always people who were good marketers in all the sort of road stand up where you had to hustle to get gigs and you had to promote yourself and you had to, you know, get in and actually, you know, do the marketing work to get the work. And almost invariably those guys weren't funny. You know, they weren't the funniest comedians, but they were by far the workingest comedians.
Sure.
You know, they actually made money and they made a career out of it.
Yeah.
And not all of them were bad, but the guys that are super talented, their brains are just fried with comedy, can't do the other stuff.
No.
You know, it's just not in their skill set. So with you, you bring a lot of that marketing skill set and you've done stand-up. Talk about, you know, getting into stand-up, because now you're trying to open a comedy club. You've got a whole, you know, sort of comedy brand that you're building. Yep. Take us through that process for you. Like when you got into comedy and, you know, how it became business-ish for you.
Sure. Yeah. So it became business pretty quickly. I mean, that's just, I told you, like I started very young with that business mentality. So it's like anything else, like that's immediately what my mind goes to when I think about things. But when it came to comedy, you know, I'm 37. I think I was 32 at the time or something like that. And I think around that, like the 30s in your life, maybe even like late 20s, depending on who you are, you start to realize like mortality, right? Like you're about to, like anything can happen,
really?
You cannot wake up.
Really? You started worrying about death at 30?
Yeah, man. Well, it's not so much
how about hard did you live, dude?
I lived hard. I've lived a hard, long life. But like the whole thing isn't about dying as so much as how do you leave this earth when you die, right? And so we don't know what's left. And this can be, it's pretty cliche, but it's the truth, at least for me, in the sense of, I think about this all the time. It's like, I don't want to wake up one day and not have made a pretty significant impact in this world. Like I'm ambitious, right? Like, I don't want to just do things small. I'm going to do things large.
Awesome. So we got a good, solid, that's a good, you know, comedy motive. Like, some of them want to be famous. You know, you want to get in and actually, you know, build something and get some heft behind you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And that's the funny thing is that, like, I've talked to some local comedians in Austin, and a story came up the other day where, like, some people, oh, I was talking to this other guy, and he runs a comedy club too. And he was telling me how some comedians don't really want to be famous. They just want to be able to go out and tell jokes, and that's, and they're content with that. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like, that's great. But it just, I can't relate to that. Like, I've never looked at anything in small. I've never pictured anything small, right? I've never pictured just doing this just for the heck of it. If I think about, even when I started doing stand-up, like, immediately my goals were get a Netflix special,
right?
You know, tour around the world, make millions of dollars.
You see the stairway to heaven.
Yes, exactly.
By the way, should be an escalator to heaven. If it's a stairway to heaven, you're going to have some calves by the time you get there.
Yes.
That's a long way. That's a long way up.
Can we start from the top of it?
Oh, I don't know. We're back. Brandon's biography is, we decided before the show started, he was going to write the biography, Fucking Kids. That was chapter 9. And
it happens when you have 11 of them, right? So
kids, you know, can't stay outside.
No, they just can't. So anyway, like, just to go back to the whole idea of, like, doing things large. And so when I set out to do comedy, I did it, you know, it was back to like 5 years ago. It was right after we moved down to Austin, and we loved it, right? Like, my wife loved it. It took me a little bit of time to get acclimated to this because I was used to living in a large city for 12 years, you know? And before that, I've always had that large city right there in my backyard.
Well, large cities, like, I remember, this is the difference for me, like, living in Austin and living in LA, is large cities make you think about bigger things. Like, you see it all the time. You see people, you know, that have ascended. You see, like, great shows and great clubs and all this stuff, and it's right there in front of your face. You don't have to imagine a thing, you know? No. And so that's one of the things I really like about, like, Los Angeles, especially for comedy, because all the best things that have, you know, flared up live out there.
Yeah.
And so you get to see it, and it does. It makes you see that connection between where you are and where they are and go, how do I get there? You know?
Exactly. You know, and it's funny because, again, like, talking through this with Jazz, like, we talk about the club and once we officially take it over and what we do with it, you know, outside of comedy, or is it a full-time, you know, kind of like going through all these details. And one of the things is just talking about the service aspect of it, right? Like, taking care of customers, the type of people you have coming through there, the opportunities, and we talked about this. We're like, it's from living in a bigger city, right? It's from living in a bigger city and seeing those opportunities, just like you just said, you know. So it there's perks to it, you know. And I love Chicago. I don't think I would ever move back to Chicago, but I love visiting it, especially during the summertime. I do miss the wintertime a little bit, but.
Well, I think people, like, who move places like Austin, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but a lot of people moving here from California and New York and everywhere else from the expensive cities because they think Austin's cheap, which it is not anymore, but it's still probably cheaper in those places. But, you know, they import all that motivation and all that ambition and all that experience down into Austin. And I ran into this a lot when I moved back here with my kids, you know, 15 years ago. And you want to import that stuff here, and you want there to be more ambition. You know, yeah. You want people to be more professional. You want to see that kind of drive to growth, you know, and drive to big success. And I tried to push it onto Austin some, and Austin, you know, potheads and amateurs. even the talented ones, like even the great, there's some real good, really strong talent here, but it doesn't know how to develop in that kind of professional, hardcore city industry way.
Yeah. And that's why, like, when you see some of the talent that you at least used to, because now they're not really leaving, but they used to leave, they get to a certain point here and they're like, well, I even need to go to New York or I need to go to LA. And they would do that and then be like almost like a slap in the face because they would have to realize they have to do things professionally. You know?
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, you do not get that training here. And they went out there and like, I used to tell people who would come up to me about writing, like they knew I was a professional writer and I'd worked in the industry. So they all want to know how do I get a job? And I'm like, put together 3 pages of great jokes to start, about 25 jokes, 30 jokes, whatever. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, I'll look at them for you. I'll help you develop it so that when a professional showrunner looks at it, they'll be like, yeah, this is solid. Let's talk to this person.
Yeah.
They would send me something. They'd send me a bunch of jokes. And I'm like, well, these two are kind of close. Let's work on those. And they'd be like, what do you mean? I like them all. I'm like, well, they're not all good. So I don't know what to tell you. And then they would just quit. That'd be it. I'd never hear from them again.
Yeah. That's rough, man. It's just a different mentality. You're right. You know,
but you've got the right mentality. You're a big city guy. You're ambitious. And now you're coming up on, you know, talk about starting the brand and the club and, you know, the stuff where you're at.
Sure. Yeah. If you don't mind, I'll just go back real quick about so when I was starting, I realized, you know, all that shit was coming about and I was like, I want to do stand up. Like I always love stand up. I've always been a big fan of stand up. And so I decided to give it a shot and I started doing stand up after like spending a few months of kind of researching and all that shit, which was just funny to me though, is that there's really like as much research as you do, at least back then, I don't know how it is now because I don't do that research, but to like learn how to write a joke and do all that, like there's nothing out there. Yeah. It's like, you literally have to like learn it on the whim. And I think honestly, I've learned more now as a producer about how to write a joke and how to tell a joke than when I was actually trying to do stand up. And maybe it's just years, right? Like years of just being involved and just seeing it and repetition and all that stuff. But back then it was extremely hard. So I gave it a shot and I started doing it.
And I think you're right. Like I just interrupt whenever you say something I find interesting. So like that idea, you know, that idea about producer's ears for, you know, good quality product versus the talent's, you know, ears. It's hearing from outside versus hearing from inside.
Yeah.
And, you know, the producer, like if you do, like I tell people all the time, like I've listened to thousands of hours of club stand-up, live club stand-up. I would sit in the back and listen.
Yeah.
It soaks into your intuition, you know, your subconscious. And suddenly it does. It starts to take root and then you can do things you couldn't do before.
Yes.
And that's that kind of development that is really cool to see when people put in the effort.
It really is, man. And you know, it's funny that you said that because also like when I started doing stand-up, that's all I did. Like whenever I get into something, I like dive 110% into it. So like when I was driving around in the car or I was out doing something, I always was listening to live stand-up, right? Like Spotify, you can get like a bunch of stand-up albums and you can actually, they have playlists. And so you can just listen to some of the greats and listen to like Richard Pryor and Robin Williams back in the 70s and 80s. And then, Sam, in the 80s too, it was just some of the like, and George Carlton, like all the like greats, like listen back then. And then even to now, and you just listen and listen and listen. I remember, and then spending time, like hanging out with you, you would throw on Netflix and be like, watch this. And like, I remember I never heard of Patrice before. And you're like, Patrice is the best. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then we watched it and we even watched more than like 5 minutes of a clip. And I was like, fuck, he is amazing. Especially when you pointed out, it's like watching football, like football tape with a fucking football coach, right? Yeah. They point out everything. You're like, holy shit, this makes so much sense. And that's exactly what happened. And that stuff just kind of clicked. But for me, like doing stand-up, the problem I had with stand-up is doing the repetition over and over and over and over again. I had no I had no interest in doing that. I'm like, when I do stuff, I like to take on new things and new challenges. And like, once I get one story down, I want to move on to the next story. And
yeah, that's tough. That's a tough psychology for a stand-up. Exactly. People don't understand how much rote repetition there is. I mean, they call it a routine for a reason. You know, when you cook a routine and it's great at every level, the whole job becomes staying interested, you know, and you can develop other things as you're going, but it's hard on some brains, you know, for a lot of people. Again, that's one of the reasons they don't get into it professionally. Like when you do professional comedy writing, you may really like to come up with jokes. You may be a good counterpuncher when people say things. Well, now sit down at 9 a.m. and do it for 2 hours, you know, on these topics. And by God, they better be good because we need them for 2 o'clock, you know, tape rehearsal. And yep. So it's a whole different ballgame when you take all those things you love, you know, and that you've been drawn to, and you move them over into a professional skill set. And so, yeah, I think it is hard on some people.
It really is. And I think, you know, I never realized that, right? Like until I went to like certain open mics in Austin, I saw the same comedians do the same thing over and over and over again. And at first I remember being like, why the fuck are they doing that? Right? Like this is just like, they're saying the same stuff. And I didn't realize that's them working out, right? Like that's them doing bicep curls, right? Or squats. You don't just do it once and expect it to be a fucking amazing or have the like ginormous quads. You have to do it over and over again. And so I didn't realize that at first. And then when it clicked, I was like, man, I don't know if I want to do this anymore, but I did want to keep trying. And so I kept on doing it. And the first thing I wanted to do too is like all my friends where I live in Leander up north, it's like 30 minutes outside of Austin. All my friends wanted to see me do stand up. And so I was doing, I started hosting an open mic downtown, and I did everything I possibly could to try to get stage time without having to like, you know, suck on the teats of the clique of the community. And sometimes right. It's very cliquish. And so if you're new, it's not necessarily, they don't always welcome you with open arms, at least at that time. And so I just started creating my own opportunities, kind of that business mentality. Right. Yeah. And my friends, a few of them would come down and see it. And then like more people want to do it. And I was like, yo, fuck it. I'm going to do, and I talked to you about this. I'm like, I'm going to produce a show. And I found a place, and I think you were the first headliner, right? And you killed it. You killed it. People loved it. We sold, I think, 100 tickets. You got paid.
Yeah, you did. For your first gig, oh my God. Yeah. Like bar gigs are horrible in stand-up. And your bar gig was outside and great, which that never happens.
Yeah, and you know, part of it was like, I think a third of the group was my friends, but the rest, the two thirds, were just from the advertising marketing, because at the time, and I still do this, I know how to use Facebook ads. And back then, especially back then, this was like 4 years ago or closer to five, they worked really well. Mm-hmm. And so I was just able to turn it on, spend like a couple $100 on ads. And next thing you know, I made a little bit of a profit, but I got to pay all the comedians and everyone had a great time. And then we did it again the next month, and that sold, I think, 85 tickets. And then I started having some issues with the venue. And so we kind of paused that. Plus my marketing business started picking up, and then I stopped for like a year and a half. And then I remember I just started getting, signs, right? Like I'm a big into the universe and things happen for a reason. And,
it doesn't make it a good reason.
true. But entrepreneur mindset, it's like, give it a shot. If it fails, it fails. Right. But at least you got a sign that maybe it's worth the try. And so I did. People kept on asking me like, Brandon, when are you going to put on another show? When are you going to put on another show? And so I actually found a different venue, and they were fantastic. It was up in Leander Beer Market.
That one's even better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, cause they were all about it, right? Like, it was like the other venue, which was a brewery. They kind of like treated me as like I was just coming in and they were helping me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't so much as I was helping them, which is the case. Like when I bring 100 people and not a lot of them are your customers, and they're all going to be drinking. Like I know from the Leander beer market, people were averaging about $40 a tab per person. That's for 100 people. That's $4,000 in 2 hours, right? And that's all it is, 2-3 hours.
Well, and like you said, it's new customers. It's, you know, it has residual payoff for a long time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And on top of it, even if you offer it to some of your customers, right, and some of your customers come and they really enjoy it, that makes them even more loyal to you, right? And that's what happened. And so, you know, we were able to help Leander Beer Market. We did some great shows with them. I think we did from June of 2019 till the end of, or to the beginning of 2020. The last show we did there was in like February. And then I had a goal actually from that I set in 2019 that I wanted to do producing comedy shows full time. And I kind of worked out the math and what I needed to do, but I knew I had to up my game. I couldn't just do these local shows unless I wanted to scale them on a much larger scale. But instead of doing that, I was like, why don't we just go bigger and bring in bigger headliners? And so I set out and I started reaching out to some agents and agencies, and I started getting some pushback, right? Like originally when I asked to bring people in, because I was a local promoter that had really nothing behind them except for a few bar, you know, shows, they're like, eh, no, they were offering me certain talent for like $400,000 is what the guarantee had to be. And now knowing what I know now is like, that's just a big fuck you, right? Like it was just like them putting their middle finger.
Yeah, that's just them saying, hey, let's see if there's any way we can get this guy to pay this.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, let's throw out a ridiculous number. They're probably sitting in a room. They're like, hey, what number do you think? What's a large number? They're like, 400,000. They're like, okay, let's send it to them. And so, sure enough, I asked.
When you're selling into that super established
yes.
business, you know, that industry that's seen everything and it knows how to glean value out of everything and it knows what a, you know, like a real pipeline of money looks like, and then this little trickle straw of money, you know, coming towards them. It's really interesting to do business within that super established entertainment versus like here where you're like, you know, like you were saying, you're a new guy, you're doing bars, and you're like, I'm going to move up, you know?
Yeah.
And, that makes perfect sense, but your learning curve, you know, opens wide.
Yes. And it was funny. So I like, and then not only did they throw out ridiculous numbers, but now I started making some traction with a few larger agencies, and then they kept on passing me on to somebody else. Right. Like, and that's when I got the other feeling like they didn't want to talk to me. But I remember there was one partner from an agency, and I don't want to mention names because I don't want to, like, I don't know how they would feel about this, but he was great. He's been in the business for 14 years. He was a partner of that agency. It still is to this day. And he jumped on the phone. He's like, let's talk for 30 minutes. I sent an email about a client. He's like, let's talk for like 30 minutes. And so we jumped on the phone and he's like, tell me what you're doing. And then he asked me a bunch of questions. And basically at the end of it, he gave me some really good advice. He's like, Brandon, scale it back. Cause I wanted to do really big shows at first. And he was like, scale it back. He's like, let's do it. Start working like 200-300 people per show. Start building up your email, you know, all this stuff. And so it gave me some really good advice that was realistic and it helped me to bring me back down to earth. And I never forgot it. And like, I still owe that guy a ton of stuff because it helped me get to where I am. So with that,
and I think that's one of the things people miss sometimes. Like I've worked in entertainment for, you know, coming up on 35 years, and I've always tried to do that. I've always tried to give people free advice. I enjoy teaching people stuff. And I think it's also, you know, it's karma, you know, it's moral value in the bank. It's like, if I help people, I don't care if they don't even do anything back for me, but you know, there's just good spiritualism in the world of doing that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And it does come back to you. Like yes. Maybe only 8% of it, but you'll be amazed at what comes back to you.
Yeah. And when I started like business in general, I started, a lot of it was networking, right? And how I actually grew my businesses, whether it's financial or the social media or any type of marketing, I always networked and always introduced people that could help other people out, whether they were a direct customer or a potential partner. I would spend like probably 30 minutes of my day each day sending out email introductions. Like, there's a huge part of my business. And I, exactly to that point is that believing in the karma aspect of it, like giving out and not expecting anything in return, just knowing they're building up currency that the universe is going to cash in eventually and pay you forward. And so it's a healthy way of going. And I totally agree with you on that. And that's why he was one of the first people I reached out to when things start to open up and we're doing bigger shows here in Austin to where we are now, because I have that sense of loyalty to him. You know, like he helped me out. He didn't have to. Like he did not have to spend that much time on the phone with me. And I kept on following up with stuff and he would answer questions and he was great. And so that helped, but it also led.
That man is Steven Spielberg.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, actually, but no, I'm just the first show we decided to do that was going to be bigger was like a 300-person show we were going to do downtown in Austin. I found a venue, a good partner, we were bringing in Dean Del Rey, who I saw open for Bill Burr like years ago, and he fucking killed it. I mean, obviously, he only did like 15 minutes, but he fucking killed it, and I was like, all right, I talked to him. He didn't have an agent. He didn't have a manager. He did everything himself, which obviously made things a lot easier. And so we were able to work out a deal. He was going to fly down here, do the show, and had everything set up. That was March 7th, 2020. And obviously like 2 weeks prior.
Wow.
COVID hit, right? And so we went from potentially having 300 people there to only having 110, which was not bad considering the situation, but still we lost, right? And Dean came in, killed it, great show, just very light crowd of what we expected. And at that point, you know, things started to shut down. So I just decided to pivot. And when I decided to pivot, my business back then was a different name than it is now. And it also was just me. And then we pivoted to do online stuff. And we started doing online shows, but not like stand-up online shows. I personally freaking hate online stand-up.
It doesn't translate very well.
You need the crowd. There's no way to substitute that crowd, right? Like stand-up is so reliant on the energy of the crowd and the laughter of the audience and the interaction that it just does not translate at all virtually. And so our goal was every time that we set out to do these shows online, yes, they were the creators or the artists that were heading up the shows were all comedians, but it was never stand up. It was always something that was funny and relatable. And either it was like we had party time, which was just like a bunch of comedians sitting around drinking, playing party games, which was really freaking hilarious. We had another one that was like a variety show. So we had three comedians come on, do three different acts, which that was really funny. And then we had like In the Meantime, which was like a comedy game show. And so that was just creating memes and really funny memes. And so all these different shows were fun. And it also gave the artists or the comedians an opportunity to really just be funny still and grow their audience and go from there. And that was great because we got to build up a network of comedians from all across the country. At one point we had 10 shows running 7 nights a week. And so it was a lot of fun, a lot of experience. And then a lot of people, when we started doing that, we started off very basic. It was funny because if you ever watch like the Joe Rogan Experience, you see the very first episode, it's like him and Red Band with this like, you know, old ass camera. They're like, how do we move this around? And where are we? And like all this stuff in there, but it's all live on there. And that's kind of how we started. We started with just like a typical Zoom and it wasn't very pretty. We had a PowerPoint. I think the second episode, the Zoom wasn't connecting to Facebook. So I literally live streamed Facebook through my phone to my screen and it looked like complete shit, but we still got like thousands of views from that at that time. And so that was great. But then, you know, that started to die off. Like people during the pandemic got sick of watching that type of stuff. At first it was great. We had tons of views, but it just started becoming, you know, just repetitive and people didn't watch it anymore. And so we had to change our strategy. And one of the things was that Texas opened up. And when Texas started opening up, I started seeing people doing shows in Texas. And I was just like, I started getting that itch. It's like, man, we could do this again. We could do this again. But I'm like, we have to find the right opportunity. It has to be COVID safe. Like if I'm going to do a live event, it has to have some of that restrictions around it. And I want to do something big. And I want to just do it as like half-assed. So I end up meeting with Nick, who's the owner of Vulcan, through a mutual friend that was working with Big Laugh Comedy, which is the brand that we have. And she put me in touch with them. He already said that he was looking to bring in different types of acts, essentially, to Vulcan to help bring in a different crowd. Predominantly, it was an EDM club. So, which I don't know if you've ever seen an EDM show, but I have recently seen one for the first time, and it is by far the best people watching ever. Like, it's like you take
the crazy dancing.
Oh my, it's like if you took Venice Beach and you threw them in the club with a bunch of drugs, that's what it would be.
Yeah, so, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Highly entertaining to watch. I talked to Nick, worked out a great deal, and we started producing shows in the beginning of October. And we brought in, started lining up comedians. Now, the first three shows were a little light. We started kind of doing some stuff, but we kept on grinding away, making some impact, getting some buzz built around it. And then the fourth show, we sold out. It was Craig Connett came in from LA, younger comedian, very much internet famous. He's got a couple clips that are viral, stories about him driving stick for the first time, but he was on shrooms and a bunch of other drugs. And then he's got, he's also somewhat internet famous for getting fired from Trader Joe's because he farted on his manager live on Instagram. And so, you know, those sort of things that kind of projected him into the comedy world. Now, he was doing stand-up all at the same time. And you hear him tell his stories, like he was going to work at Trader Joe's, but he was still doing shows where he was on there and people were following him, and he would follow, he would open up for like Bill Burr and some of these other people that were coming out and working out material. And so, and he was hanging out with them, but he would still end up going to work at Trader Joe's. And so it was just funny to listen to this story, but he came in, killed it, sold out the show. The next show that we had was Tony Hinchcliffe, and Tony came and he had a sold out crowd too, which was larger though than Craig's because of how we structured things from a table perspective. And that's a whole nother like science right now too, is just figuring out things from a COVID perspective. But we changed things up a little bit with Tony, kind of going into good faith that he's a big enough name that he would sell that the shit out. And it was a Wednesday night. He was actually just making a stop because he was heading over to Dallas or something like that. And so he came in, sold out the show, and he happened to bring a few friends with him. He brought Ron White, and then he brought Joe Rogan. And then he brought Tony Casillas, who's out of Dallas too, who's a young, really famous, or not famous, but not yet at least, but young and very talented comedian that's up and coming. And so he brought them out, and obviously that show killed. No one knew that they were coming, at least from an audience perspective, but they did, and they crushed it. Joe hadn't done stand-up since he moved down to Austin. The first time he did it was with us. And then
is that your dog or a kid?
I think it was, yeah, my kid for sure. and then Ron hadn't done stand-up since for 8 months. And so both of them did stand-up on the stage for the first time, and it was incredible. Like they all crushed. Tony was great. And that really just opened up. Like we built some buzz around there, got some like local stories that the overall larger news outlets aren't really covering live events during the pandemic, obviously for good measure. They don't want to be held liable for anything, but you know, our shows are all socially distanced. We've never had a comedian who came back getting COVID. They all get tested before and after. Audience members too are never coming and complaining about anything. So, and listen, like people, if they don't want to come out and watch a show, it's perfectly fine. They don't have to. But if you do and you want to see something in a safe environment, that's what we're providing for people right now.
Do you want a suggestion from something I saw today on the internet?
Sure.
China, the Wuhan province, has determined that using anal swabs is far more effective as a COVID test.
I saw that highlight, the headline. Saying,
right? If you want to brand your show.
We got anal swabs. That's like 100% accurate. So don't worry. All right. So just to go down that rabbit hole for a second, if they do the nasal swabs and how far they go there, how far do they have to go with the anal?
I don't know. I didn't really explore. Give it a quick. That's funny. So yeah, you got the that sort of massive breath of celebrity, you know, whooshing into your world a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and
so just to go back real quick though, too, is like the opportunity kind of arose from the fact that Cap City during the middle of this pandemic closed the doors. Like that was a big story, right? Like everyone was very upset. And you know, and to me it was like, oh crap, you know, this is an opportunity. That's kind of what I said. Like it's horrible that it happened, but I was like, this is a great opportunity for us. And so that's why when I talked to Nick and Volpe came up, I was like, yes, we need to do this. And sure enough, I mean, doing it, like I believe that if we didn't do it the right way though, we wouldn't be able to continue to do what we're doing right now. And we did do it the right way, and we continue to do it the right way, and we continue to make improvements too, because it's not perfect by any means. I mean, we essentially have converted an EDM club into a comedy club, like part-time. And so we have to make adjustments to that, but it works. And for the most part, the comedians are happy. There have been some suggestions from them specifically on how to make it better, which we take into account from every perspective. And I've even heard feedback from audience members too. And I personally, at every show, am walking around, listening it over here, listening over there, watching it from this angle, watching it from this angle, so we can make those improvements to make sure that we're providing the best show possible.
I think that's super important. I think, you know, when I try to teach people, you know, rhetoric construction, message construction, I try to point out, you know, everybody tries to do this stuff on their own. Like if you are trying to convince your crazy uncle of something, you say a couple of things at Thanksgiving and it blows up and you quit. I'm like, well, look at what professional persuaders bring to things. Like if they have a difficult target or something that's important to them, they bring to bear the amount of resources that you've pulled together and this customer service, you know, orientation you have and this constant improvement and gathering all the information to make it better and better and better so that it gets to the point where it can actually be effective as a message environment, as opposed to, I just can't persuade, you know, crazy Jeff. I'm like, well, crazy Jeff needs more, you know, and a guy like you, and it's one of the reasons I've always kind of admired you, you know, I've talked to a ton of people who have energy about getting into comedy in different ways, even from the producer perspective, but you do the work. You actually put out the effort. You listen, you're a good dude. You're doing the work and you will be successful when you get good opportunities under that condition. So, you know,
I appreciate that. Yeah. And you're right. You know, it's funny just to talk about, you know, convincing people. One thing I've always, cause like I was always in the world of sales too, really. When you're an entrepreneur, sales is a big part of what you do. And so sales, obviously, it's convincing people that whatever you're selling is what they should be buying. And one thing I always learned, someone told me this, they're like, it's not, you don't have to tell people what you want to hear. You have to tell them what they want to hear. And so if you actually want to convince somebody, you just need to know what makes them tick. So if you tell someone not to do something and you know they're going to do it, that's how you get them to fucking do it. You know, or make them think it's their idea and they'll do it. And so that's something I always, you know, admired and seen from people's perspectives is like just trying to, you know, put it in their minds. And that's, and it doesn't change. Like I do this in the comedy world all the time, right? Like making it as their idea, they're going to buy into it a lot better. So
you can have all these sub skills that you need to do what you're doing. I mean, to be a producer is really, and a lot of people don't even know that what that job means, but a producer is essentially the person who puts together everything that needs to be there in order for something to happen. They monitor all the problems. They make sure all the resources are there. So they put the whole apparatus together and they have to know each piece of it. Cause if one piece of it's off, the whole thing doesn't work.
Correct.
That's why producers are so important in message construction and Hollywood and stand up and things like that is they have to have this super aggregate awareness of all of it. And they have to have a quality judgment for all of it, that it can't go below this quality because it's going to, you know, kill everything over here.
Yeah.
And having that kind of big orientation so that you can, you know, build something that works holistically, and people come in and then they do get the right experience of it. They are persuaded, or they do find it funny. And, you know, then there's real value in what you're offering at that point.
Absolutely. It's always about value, right? And like with the comedy shows, you know, when we set out, our goal was always to bring in bigger names, right? But the reason for the bigger names is that we just didn't have a name to ourselves. So we needed those bigger names to help sell us tickets. And I've never had a problem with paying comedians what they deserve, right? Like if they're coming in, their name has a lot of, if they have a strong brand and a big following, then yes, they deserve a majority of the ticket sales. And that's perfectly fine. And so for us though, it's just, we're capturing some of their audience, knowing that if we do a good job, they'll come back. They'll come back and see somebody else. Maybe they like them, they heard of them. But one thing that really stuck out to me is that recently in the last couple of weeks, I got an email from somebody and they were like, actually we had to reschedule a show, which was the first time we ever had to do that. And people were really upset because it was Donnell Rawlings, and he's very attached obviously to Dave Chappelle. And Dave is doing some of his own stuff, and Donnell feels a sense of, you know, loyalty, a big sense of loyalty to Dave for his career and everything. So a lot of times he follows down the path of what Dave's doing, which is fine. That's great. It's fantastic. But he had to reschedule a show, and I had to let people know. And some of the feedback was they were upset, right? Like rightfully so, people were going to be upset that they were really excited about seeing one of their favorite comedians, and that person had a reschedule on them, and now they don't know exactly when they're going to go see them. And so they started like sending me messages, and I was just, you know, being completely understanding and giving people back their money, because I believe 100%, like a lot of times comedy clubs or comedy shows won't refund money, and I never got that. I remember I've been to a couple of times that bought shows to a comedy club and decided like change the plans, or we weren't going to be able to make it, or our babysitter fell through, and I spent like, you know, $80, and they were like, no, we're not, you can't get it. And there's no credit either. And it's like, what the fuck? That's horrible.
Right.
So I made sure that I changed that experience now that I get to control the situation and give people what I think they deserve, which is their money back. So anyway, the point of the story though, is that I got a message from a guy who was like, listen, I just want a refund. I'm pretty upset that I wasn't able to go see him, and I'd rather take that money and invest it in some of the other shows that you have coming up. I was like, great, here. And I refunded him this money. And then we start talking. He's like, who do you have coming up this weekend? And I said, we actually have Death Squad Secret Show, which is Brian Redband. And he brings some friends. And there's, you know, quite a bit of LA comedians that moved out here. But Redband and I have developed a relationship now that we're doing this weekly show with Death Squad. And it's a secret show. And it's really just for comedians, the larger comedians. He kind of controls the talent and when they come in, but they get to come up there and work out some material and practice. And they only get like 15, 20 minutes, depending on who they are, you know? And so so I told him we had this secret show coming up, but I was like, hey, here's a couple names that are going to be on that. But I'm like, one name you should really know is Dustin Ybarra, who actually is not new to the stand-up comedy scene. He actually started kind of coming up with like Chris D'Elia and some of those other cats. And he's been in the business for a while, and he's friends with like a lot of the larger comedians. He just hasn't gotten that recognition that other comedians have gotten, but he's fucking killer. He's so funny. And I told this guy, I was like, yo, watch Dustin. So he came to the show the next day, and he sent me an email back the next morning, like, yo, you were absolutely right about Dustin. He was worth the entire ticket for the entire show just to see his 20 minutes. He was worth it. And he's like, I forever will trust your opinion for every time you tell me to come see somebody. I was like, cool. That's all I asked for. Right. And
that kind of specific, you know, like you said, delivery of something that deliver value to somebody, you establish trust. And at that point they stop questioning you. You know, everybody questions you until they get to know you.
Yep.
You know, unless you've got this kind of super brand, like, you know, somebody like Joe Rogan or Ron White, you know, decades in the business, you know, of super success, they have a golden ticket on trust.
Correct.
But you can go to their, you can go to their shows and get a bad show sometimes. You never know what, you know, state they're going to be in, but nobody questions it before they go. Whereas like little guys coming up, because they don't know you and, you know, all that stuff, like you've got to do that credibility work. And, you know, I think that's your big challenge right now, right? Mm-hmm. Is getting, you know, enough cred with enough consistent success that the brand itself just says quality and people will buy tickets off the brand.
Yeah. And that's, you're absolutely right. Like you nailed it on that. That is our biggest challenge as of date right now, is just to have that trust, right? And we'll get there. Like the great thing about this is that because we put on a good show, the bigger names do want to come on and work with us. And so, you know, we have to, that's, these are things that we're building up to. But like, you know, for example, Eddie Griffin's people reached out to us.
I'm sorry, Eddie Griffin's people reached out to you. Sorry.
But he's a bigger name, right? Like, and regardless of like what you think of him personally or whatever, he's still.
I'm just giving him shit. I saw him all the time at the Comedy Store. You're getting a lot of Comedy Store guys coming in now. Like Andrew Dice Clay will call you next.
Who?
Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh yeah. See, perfect. Yeah. I would love to see Andrew Dice. Although he's like one of those guys, it's like when you see like a music act after their prime, you're like,
Well, Eddie Griffin, all those guys are the same thing. Like they super talented guys, had their day. But to me, like the Comedy Store was always a little bit of that mausoleum of comedy.
Yeah.
Because they would all, they hung out there and that's where they, you know, continue to do their work.
Sure.
And you know, you'd see flare ups of their talent and they'd be great. But then a lot of times they're dialing, you know, just sort of phoning it in, and it's like, okay, you know, you're on the stage, you might as well try, dude.
Yeah.
But you'll it'll be interesting, you know, because now you've, you know, you've opened up the La La Land, the gates of La La Land.
Yes.
It's its own world, man. There's a lot of clog in La La Land where it's, you know, actors and names and things like that, but they're, you know, they're not delivering, you know, the kind of funny that you're talking about, up and comers working really hard on their show, doing fresh stuff. It's a complicated environment, and you'll, you know, you'll start to feel some of that. I'm sure you'll do fine with it though, but.
Yeah. And this is what I think about it is like, they have deals, you know, when you look at it from the back end, they have deals where they're going to make thousands and thousands of dollars. And essentially like, and they probably will sell out the show. I have no doubt that like the larger names will sell out shows just because people still want to come out and see these names. They have that credibility, right? Like even if it's not the greatest show, like I went to go see Dave Chappelle when him and Joe were here and they're doing their shows and all that stuff. And I saw one of them and I've seen Dave before. And that was not one of Dave's best performances. Yeah. Now, obviously his show is not geared for like headlining. It's not supposed to do a full like, He's slated to do a full 60 minutes, but he kind of like does his own fucking thing because he's Dave Chappelle. Now, honestly, if I was a person and I had to pay for those tickets, I wouldn't have been very happy for it. But I was lucky enough to get them as comp tickets and it was a great show. I think everyone else did a really good job. He just happened to get really drunk on it. And that just kind of turned, it was funny, but it was just, it wasn't like, it's right. Not a typical show you're used to, like a headlining show, right? Yeah. So that's just the difference between it.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Like you'll get, there's a maturation in your producer, you know, knowledge that your learning curves are about to, you know, become roller coasters.
Yes.
Because you bring somebody in because they're a name and then they end up being a total, you know, problem to deal with. Or sometimes you bring people in and their name and they're an angel and they work really hard, like they're an opener or something. Like it's amazing the range that you get, and you'll get that kind of, you'll start to get that sense.
Yeah.
Like I worked with a guy once who was a great stand-up. His name was Kenny Rogerson from the 80s, a Boston guy, and should have been like super famous, was like just super talented and a great character, but had a little bit of a substance issue with alcohol.
Sure.
And they put it, this was the first time I ever got paid to open a comedy club and comedy off Broadway or on Broadway in Lexington, Kentucky, great comedy club. And they put it in the rider of his contract. He couldn't drink. And so he came in and he knew the rider was there and he bribed the bartender with like $200 and set him up with shots without the owner knowing it. And halfway through his headlining set, he passed out on stage.
Oh, geez.
And then woke up after about 30 seconds and just stumbled off and passed out in the green room. And the middle act comes running out to me and goes, he's off stage. I'm like, what do you mean he's off stage? He's 20 minutes in. It's like, so I walked in there and the whole room was just like kind of laughing. And I went on stage and I'm like, what happened? They're like, he got drunk and passed out and he's gone. And I'm like, oh shit, what do we do now? You know, I was an opener. I didn't have any more material.
Yeah.
So the feature came up and finished out the show. But, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of stories of like that because, you know, entertainment, the fun part of entertainment is you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's glorious. Sometimes it's horrendous.
Yes.
But, you know.
I love your stories. Like every time you tell a story from the comedy world, it's just always amazing. So I love hearing, you should just have a podcast of just all your stories or like write a memoir or some shit like that.
Yeah, but, yeah. Anytime you're in the business, you collect a lot of that stuff. So it's fun. I like to listen to those too.
But you're right though. Is like I am experiencing more and more of those things and those kind of stories and those situations. And you're right. Like I don't know what to expect for some of these larger shows, but I've always said this is like I want to go into it and do things, and if it works out, great. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. You know. And for the most part, I think what we're doing is we're putting our right foot forward and making shit happen. Like, man, when Donnell, like that whole thing with Donnell, that was a first time experience. Like we didn't have much time to turn around, but what, like my first mindset was like, shit, we already have like half these tickets sold. But two, like obviously we didn't cash it out. So it was just sitting there so we can refund people money and not have to worry about that. But the other thing was, is like, well, I'm supposed to two shows this weekend. Like, and so what are we going to do? And that's when, like, the way my mind thinks, Jeremiah Watkins came out the weekend before that, and he brought Red Band. And that's actually how I met Red Band, was when he came and did a guest spot on there. And then Jeremiah also brought, like, David Lucas, who's a regular on the Kill Tony show, who's extremely funny and extremely hardworking. And William Montgomery, who's the same, he's a regular, also very funny, very hardworking. And so Red Band brought a good crew. Jeremiah brought Red Band brought everybody else. And they all did it and all killed it. And I talked to Red Band afterwards and I got his contact info. And then when this happened, I was reached out to him. He's like, hey man, you want to do this? He's like, I actually used to do a Death Squad sticker show. And then blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, cool, let's do it. And we put it together. I talked to him Saturday night. We finalized everything on Sunday. I started pushing it out on Monday. The first show was Friday. We had another show Saturday. We sold out both those shows in a very short period of time. And again, I was so freaking nervous. Didn't know what to expect. Cause you go into something new, you don't know what to expect, but man, was that incredible. And I was like, hey, I'm like, we actually happen to have next weekend open too. Do you want to do two more? He's like, hell yeah. So we did two more the next weekend and we sold out one show. Like the other show was a little light, not really too light. Like we were like four tables away from selling out, and we could have, cause I don't think we did, but we got close to it. But either way, like still getting that close for four shows, essentially sold out three out of four shows, was pretty freaking good in such a short period of time. But now we're going to do that on a weekly basis. And so we kind of know what to expect. But, you know, it's just about, you know, opportunities and finding that stuff and working through it. And I think, you know, it's funny. It's like you can sit there and you can fucking squawk and like whatever bullshit comes up. You know, someone didn't do a good show, or if the ticket sales didn't go the right way, or someone canceled on you or rescheduled, or you can make the best out of the situation and find an opportunity in it. And that's, I think, what the successful people do, right? Like no matter who you are in life, one way or another, you're going to fall into a curveball. It's like, what are you going to do with that curveball, though?
Yeah, for sure. You got to, and that's, again, one of the reasons I have confidence in you. You have good scramble skills, good improvisational skills. You don't get down too quickly when, you know, you hit by the curveball in the temple, you know, and you wake up in the hospital. You're like, oh, I guess I'll duck next time. You know, but you're good at that. And I really, you know, admire that and that energy that you bring to it.
That's from all the experiences of getting hit in the temple. So I learned my lesson after about six times.
Well, cool, man. I will let you go. We've gone, you know, like over an hour. I always go over an hour because I just get interested in, you know, what people are doing. So
yeah, I appreciate it.
we'll have you back. Like, keep plugging, man. And we'll have you back and you can tell me about your successful comedy club, you know, Brandon's Place.
Yeah. Big Laugh Comedy Club. That's the name of it. So
good name. Good name. How do you beat, you know, that's pretty clear what the offer is.
Exactly.
Big Laugh Comedy Club. Well, awesome, man. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having this, having me on, and for doing the show too. Like, I always love good quality podcasts, you know, and everyone has one nowadays, but it's always good to actually find the good ones out there, because there are plenty of good ones.
So you can go to Big Laugh Comedy Network. Is that where you find you, on Facebook or?
Yeah. So Facebook is Big Laugh Comedy. You can search Big Laugh Comedy on Instagram. It's Big Laugh Comedy Network. And so you can find us both on those, and you can go to our website, BLC Comedy, or blcomedy.com. And you can find all the upcoming shows and our social media and all that good stuff there. So,
awesome.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Good deal. Thanks for listening to the podcast, everybody. We are Rhetoric Warriors. We are always helping the good people beat the bad people, because that's just a better option. Just learn better rhetoric and get more victories. So we'll see you next time.